Today is May 3rd, it's Thursday morning at the JCC. We're studying Providence, especially in the Wars of the Lord of the Ralbag, of course. And we can't, of course, do a full review of the Ralbag, it'll take us all class, but you will just remember that we're basically dealing with four different versions of Providence. Right. The version of Providence that the Ralbag holds by and wants to prove is the following. That there's Providence for some of the people, some of the time. Right? That's the Ralbag, and that's what we're trying to prove. I'll be writing on the board, Providence, Ralbag. And he also tells us this is the position of the Rambam also. And it's some of the people, some of the time. Some of the people, some of the time. And in order to prove his position, the Ralbag says I have to eliminate all the other possible positions. So what are the other possible positions? So one of them, says the Ralbag, is all of the people, all of the time. Right? All of the people, all of the time. And of course, the other possible position that he has to eliminate is all of the people, some of the time. All of the people, some of the time. And the Ralbag says,
it leaves us, none of the people know.
That there is one other possible position, right? Is there one other possible position?
Yes.
Which is?
None of the people, none of the time.
None of the people, none of the time. And that indeed, we said, is also on the table, although he considers that pretty much refuted from the beginning. Right? That was the position of Aristotle, but if Jay mentioned it, we could put it here. None of the people, none of the time. So these are the possible positions. The final position here is attributed to Aristotle, and the Ralbag believes that he has refuted that, so I will just write Aristotle. And then we have the first two positions that I put after the Ralbag, all of the people all of the time, and all of the people some of the time.
Right.
So the Ralbag labeled these two positions according to names of characters in the book of
Job.
Right. And if I remember correctly, we first want to talk about Eliphaz. The Ralbag said that Eliphaz holds all of the people some of the time. So I'll write here Eliphaz. All this, of course, is on the sheets that I gave out. Eliphaz. And the Ralbag also feels he's refuted that already in what we've read. What's left is all of the people all of the time. And that, remember, the Ralbag subdivided into two positions. And we're going to name them by names in the book of Job, as the Ralbag does. Right? We have Bildad, and we have Sophar. And the difference between their two positions was how to justify, how to legitimize the position that all of the people all the time have providence, whereas when we look at life, it doesn't seem to be so. And the different justifications were the following. Bildad and Sophar, one of them said the reason that it doesn't look like all of the people all of the time have providence is because we don't know how to judge people's potentiality for good. We only see their deeds and we say, this guy did good deeds but got bad, and this guy did bad deeds but got good. There's no providence. Well, we have to understand, explains the Ralbag, for one of these two, if I actually should remember which is which, Right, so this is so far, we're explaining that. So far says, no, providence doesn't go according to an absolute standard of deeds. It goes on the basis of a relative standard of deeds vis-a-vis, in comparison to, your innate potential. So let me finish the thought, okay? And then...
I'm sorry, I meant to come before class started. I just wanted to let you all... I think everybody should have gotten the email about Mo's daughter and... No, okay. So
no, when did you send it?
The other day.
Okay, Monday?
I know, but I got a jillion email that I can't just pick up.
Okay, well, Mo's daughter passed away. A funeral was yesterday.
Mo's daughter passed away?
Yes.
Oh.
And, hi. And there's a Shiva minion tonight. I can get the, I'll print out the information and bring it in here for those who don't have it. So there's Shiva minion tonight, and again, I believe on Saturday night at 7, and then Monday night. And Sunday afternoon, there's a minion that's more oriented towards teens at somebody else's home. So
Sunday night, there's nothing at the...
No, they're just having a teen minion on... I mean, you're welcome. Anyone's welcome to come to that, but it will be.
But they're not going to do the 7 o'clock meeting.
They're not going to do the 7 o'clock.
But they will on Monday and Tuesday.
For sure, Monday. Would they still be doing? I don't know about Tuesday. I haven't heard yet about Tuesday, but for sure, Tuesday.
Can I ask?
Yes.
Mail in something for that grand fund.
Okay.
Can you tell me the date?
I'm sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt the class. I'll print out and bring in the information.
Okay, so we're going back now to so far. So when you look at a person's deeds and compare them to their recompense, if you don't see a one-to-one correspondence, it's because God doesn't judge the deeds on an absolute standard, but on a relative standard, relative to their abilities, to their capacities. And you don't know what their innate moral capacity is. Only God knows. That's so far. Whereas Bildad takes the same position all the people all the time. There is providence. And why doesn't it jive? Not because you don't know people's innate capacities, but rather because you don't really see what happens to the person ultimately. You today see them getting evil when they did good and getting good when they did evil, but you have to look 5 and 10 and 15 and 20 and 30 years into the future, he says, because if they did good and now they get evil, that evil is certainly in order to bring them good in the future, but you just don't see it. And so vice versa. And that is basically a summary of everything we've done, and even a little bit more than we've done. We're about to finish that up right now. Harry.
But I have in my notes that according to Aristotle, when divine providence happens, it happens in a general order,
right,
not individualistic.
You're right. I should have put a, here on the board, individual providence. Individual providence is what we're talking about. Jay.
Well, but I'm too, I'm having the names confused, but Bildad, who is all people all the time, but you just don't see the horizon because it's too far in your future. But it seems like that is immediately contradicted by people whose lives are vanished, evaporated, right in the present. There is no future. It seems like that would immediately nullify that argument.
Good. The Ralbag did say that Bildad could bring the argument of the future life and of what happens to your progeny. But in the end, you're right, the Ralbag refutes everything on the board except for the Ralbag's position himself, which is only some of the people, only some of the time. And as you can see from the board, the Ralbag in the end takes the most constricted position vis-a-vis divine providence. If you believe it at all, then he limits it to some of the people only and only some of the time. All the other positions he ends up refuting. That's where we are. So let's pick it up. And now that we're picking it up, we're going to pick it up in two places, of course. One in the text and the other in the summary sheet so we can follow along. So as far as the text goes, you don't have the text from 2 weeks ago?
I just had my eyes dilated. I can't read.
Oh, you can't see us.
I can only listen.
Okay, so I don't have to give you the text. Okay, so then Aaron, do you have the text?
Yes.
Good. So, in the text, we're on page 172. Oh, you don't have page numbers there.
Yes,
I forgot.
Yes, we do. Some of
you do. Page 172 and 173 looks like this, right? 173 ends with blank space. 172 and 173. Those of you who have the page numbers written in can help those who don't have the page numbers written in. No, we're looking at the text now.
What text?
Got it.
The text of the Ralbag, the text of Wars of the Lord. Yeah. No, is that it? Does it say on the top, not punish their progeny? Jim, do you have the place? Okay. Chip, do you want me to help you find it?
Maybe so.
Okay, let me help you find it.
Thank you, Rabbi.
No problem at all.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Divine Providence. Here we are.
Thank you, Rabbi.
So right in there, 172, 173.
Thank you very much.
And we're ready to roll?
No.
Not yet. Ready to crawl. Okay, so you'll have to look on. Does anyone need help finding the place in the text?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm coming over to Harry.
Let's see.
Okay, so we're ready to roll. So everyone has a place in the text, and now please let's make sure everyone has a place in the summary sheets. So I'm holding up the summary sheets. And we have reached on the summary sheets to the second side, that is to say the back of the first piece of paper. And we've gotten to two at the very bottom where it says the refutation of Tzofar. The refutation of Tzofar. Refutation. Okay? And of course, Tzofar is right on the board here. So everyone now can connect from a multiple number of vantage points. Tzofar says all the people all the time. And we're going to refute his view. He says all the people all the time, and if it doesn't look like that, it's because you don't know people's potential. So we're reading now from the first paragraph, the top of page 172. It's about seven lines down from the top, but it said it's clear. Everyone see the words, it is clear?
Yes.
Great. Here we go. At 10:25, we made it. It is clear that experience refutes Tzofar's view as well. Experience. In other words, empirically, we can refute the view that there's providence to all the people all the time. Observation reveals that many men receive benefits at certain times and suffer evils at other times, although at the time of the evil, they are more inclined to do good than when they're recipients of good fortune. Like, there's not a one-to-one correspondence. Instead of getting good when you do good and getting bad when you do bad, sometimes it's the opposite. So there can't be providence to all the people all the time. This difficulty cannot be dissipated by appealing to different moral capacities. Right? That was the claim of Tzofar, that we get over the issue, get over the difficulty, get over the tension between theory and reality, by saying that it's not a matter of your deeds, but of your moral capacity, your deeds in relationship to your moral capacity. Says the Ralbag, that won't work. For this is one and the same individual, and his moral capacity with which he has been created is one and the same. Understand what he said? Right? If there's a person who did good, and then he gets good, and then he continues to good and gets bad, you can't claim that the change in his fate is a result of a change in his moral capacity, because that doesn't change over life. Moral capacity is constant. You're born with it.
You mean you can't change? Who says you can't?
You can't change your moral capacity.
Why
you
not?
Can change the degree to which you live up to your moral capacity, but you can't change your capacity.
Well, who's to say that there's a preordained level of moral capacity?
The Ralbag said that Sofar invented that idea in order to try and overcome the tension between reality and theory.
Okay.
Right? There might not be such a thing as moral capacity, but the point is, says the Ralbag, even if we posit such a thing, it doesn't help. It doesn't help. But then the Ralbag gets sophisticated, and he goes out on a limb to try and justify it so far, in the end, to show that even going on a limb won't help. He says the following: unless, however, we were to admit that the differences in reward and punishment among men are due to the differences in the moral quality of their deeds, not in their particular capacities, as Sohar had originally suggested. So what I think he means, and I've gone over this at least 100 times in the past few months, what I think he means is the following. Granted, we can't say that your fate is a direct function of your deeds. That's not borne out by reality. And granted, we can't say that it's a function of your deeds in relationship to your moral capacity, because we said moral capacity doesn't change, but fate sometimes does change. So, says the Ralbag, perhaps you want to say that, how can I explain this? Perhaps you want to say that God judges you not according to your absolute deeds, and not according to your moral capacity, but rather according to the degree in which in the past you managed to actualize your moral capacity. I'll say that again. Moral capacity doesn't change, but it could be that as you manage more and more to actualize your moral capacity, God ups the standards for you. Right? It's a fascinating idea. Moral capacity doesn't change, but in a certain sense it does. Moral capacity, you can say, I'm saying the same thing in different language now, moral capacity does change. To the degree that you develop good, better and better habits, and you manage to go further and further in actualizing your moral capacity, well, that makes it much, much easier to continue to actualize your moral capacity, and therefore the standard gets higher. The better you've done in the past, the more God demands of you in the future.
That there's no difference between that and a varying moral capacity.
Right. It's almost identical to saying that moral capacity does change.
Well, it's like exercise. I mean, if you do the same routine over and over again, pretty soon your muscles do those very things, and your trainer has to up the scale.
Exactly. Fantastic. And the same thing is true on the other side of the coin. If you had an X moral capacity, and you don't exercise at all, and your moral muscles become atrophied, then perhaps God lowers the standard. So just let me finish the thought. Okay, then there's two issues, Jay and Dorothy. So the Ralbag invents this sophisticated adjustment of Sofar's theory of moral capacity in order to try and work with all different possible understandings of so far to see if they will solve, if these understandings will solve the issue of the contradiction between the theory and reality. But the Rabbah will say in the next sentence, but this doesn't help. Because we still see that people's fate, their deserts, don't have anything to do with their deeds. Because if you take this theory that moral capacity can change, and as your deeds get better, the standard becomes higher, but what we'd expect then? We'd expect that the reward you're getting becomes a little bit less if you do the same deeds. But if your deeds get better, still, your fate should be better. But it's not true. It doesn't happen. So says the Ralbag, good try. And it's a fascinating psychological insight, but it doesn't work. Okay, so Jay first, and then Doris, Dorothy.
This is the argument that was put forth in the book and in the movie Catch-22. And this is a Catch-22. But the character Yosarian, who was told he only had so many missions to fly before he didn't have to fly any more missions, which terrified him. The reward was not having to do it, but they kept upping the number of missions that he had to fly. And that was part of the humor and the pathos of Catch-22, and that's what this is too. And so it's that idea that goes unpunished. Exactly. That's better put. Right. So the more that you do, the more good deeds you do, it's harder than your the bar has been raised, and it seems to me that is problematic.
He's saying it's problematic also.
But you're saying it's problematic for a different reason than what the Ralbag says. The Ralbag says it's problematic because it just doesn't solve the issue. But you're saying it's internally problematic. It's internally contradictory.
It seems contrived that there would be a system that was so dynamic with respect to absolutes, such as moral capacity.
I don't agree. I think that the theory is actually very, very fair, and it really fits very well with the example Carol Ann gave. Right? Because if I have X moral capacity and I manage to actualize it more and more, well, that means I become habitually better, and therefore it's going to be a little bit easier for me to continue getting better. So if I don't continue getting better, I'm not living up to the standard.
But Rabbi, we don't know what our moral capacity is.
Fine, but whatever it is. Let's say there's a scale of 1 to 10, and I'm 5.
As you attempt to actualize it, it is a moving target because it's being raised, and you don't know that either.
But the raising it is a good thing. Like the example that Carol Ann gave.
No,
she gave it isn't. The opposite of that. She said
because
no good deed.
No, before that, the trainer,
saying, you know, yeah,
the personal muscle, trainer.
You know, when you do a certain exercise routine, mm-hmm. after you've done it so long, the muscles, you don't get any improvement because the muscles know how to do that so easily. So you get a harder routine.
You have to step up.
You step up.
And that
affects your muscles.
So in the same sense, let me just say this, and we have Dorothy and Joe. So that means that as I come closer and closer to meeting my moral capacity, it gets easier and easier, and therefore the reward for the present level I've reached should get less and less, because it gets easier and easier to lift the weights, the same weight. And therefore, God says, if you want to keep getting the same benefit, well, up your behavior. To me, it makes perfect sense. But again, it doesn't solve the issue.
It is a moving target.
So Dorothy wanted to speak and Joe wanted to speak.
Okay. So, with this philosophy, if I were born into a slum, God's environment around me was basically not with a very low moral capacity type of situation, then God would have a lower standard for me than if I were born into a middle class or wealthy area environment of my existence.
That's God's an interesting application. That's an interesting application.
Because I don't have the experience and the environment to reach a higher standard.
I don't
know the difference.
I think that's a good application of what he's saying. I think it does make sense.
It's almost a fetus, though. It's kind of like, how does that person come out of that? I mean, people are born into these environments and become brilliant writers. I mean, there was a black guy. I can't remember.
No, of course.
Yeah, see, I don't think that. I don't think because the people you know that came out of that and had a very high moral standard.
On the other hand,
from a slum, that you're going to have low moral capacity. Well,
okay. So first of all,
they don't have any experience of the higher level because the environment they live in. They need to use the word low class, but that's, I don't know any other way to
yeah.
put it. And why would God have a lowest standard for them?
So listen, first of all, what Dorothy is saying is not exactly what the Ralbag is suggesting. It's an application of it, but I think it's a legitimate application. So he's talking about the capacity you're born with as far as your genes. That's what he's talking about.
It's not your environment.
But Dorothy points out, wait a second, you could probably say the same thing if you want to accept the Ralbag, not only concerning nature, but also concerning nurture. And the truth is that I actually buy what Dorothy is saying. In other words, if someone comes with an innate lower moral capacity or comes from an environment that is less nurturing of a higher moral capacity, in both cases, I'm going to praise that person more for reaching a 2 on the moral scale than I'll praise someone with a higher capacity who reaches the same 2 on that scale. I'll praise that person more for reaching even lower levels on the scale of his deeds. And then, as his deeds get better, I will give him less and less praise for reaching the 2 and expect of him to reach the 3. Going back to what the Ralbag said and what Caroline said about the personal trainer. And as he gets himself out of the slums and increases his good habits, I will continue to up the bar and give him less and less praise for the level he's already accomplished.
Issue here, and we're mixing them, has to do with the fixed or variable nature of your capacity. In one case, we're saying that there is a fixed capacity, and then we're making these measurements, or God's making these measurements, against a fixed capacity. Now, that's one situation. The other situation is that the capacity is variable, maybe by environment, or maybe by the definition that God says that as you get better at doing your deeds, we're going to vary it, then that's another interpretation that you can't really mix the two. And if the second one is true, where there is a variable capacity, then no one will ever reach their capacity. Mm-hmm. And the most religious and observant of individuals will never make it.
That's why you assume that religious and reaching.
Say that again.
Why being religious?
Well, that's really, but that's a side point.
It's really not, because if you go back to what we talked about a couple of sessions back, a lot of this is, in essence, preordained or Darwinian or something of that nature.
Yeah, but you're taking exception to some verbiage that I use that may not be totally accurate for the point that I'm trying to make.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And
so it's a point that Joe made. My response is twofold. My response is, even if you're completely correct, that's fine.
Yeah, neither one of them are very good. I can't buy either one of them. Just the point that is, we can't mix the two.
Okay, so we can't mix the two. There are two different ways of looking at things.
Yeah.
And even we take this, let's take the second view of this variable moral capacity. And again, the example of the weight trainer is very good in my mind.
Yeah.
And says, Joe, we can never reach our capacity. Now, if Joe is right, I say fine. But I think he's wrong. Let me explain. Because take the example of the weight trainer. You can always increase your weightlifting up to a certain ceiling, which is determined by your fixed capacity at birth. In other words, each person has a range that is determined by nature. And within that range, you can reach here or here or here or here or here, but you can't go beyond it.
So you're,
I think.
But what you're doing is you're taking the variable and you're now reinterpreting it as fixed.
No, it's variable.
The variable is fixed for each person. Each person has a different moral capacity, just like each person has a different capacity in weightlifting or in sprinting.
Yeah,
but within that capacity, you can improve it or you can not improve it, but only up to the limits of your capacity.
But the limits of your capacity is fixed.
For each person, differently.
For each person. Well, we're talking about individuals.
Yeah,
well, then that's the fixed environment, not the variable environment.
It just, there's a ceiling.
No, there's a ceiling.
If there's a ceiling, then it's fixed.
Well, so, but there's a lot of range.
Well, all of this has to do with individual, because even with the fixed capacity, each individual has a different fixed capacity.
And there's variables within the fixed.
Yes.
I think so.
Yes, Joe, because let's say that this is the range of capacity for human, whatever he is, whoever he is.
An individual.
Yeah, but it's the capacity for mankind.
Well, then...
That's fixed.
Yeah.
Then, within that, there's different variations. So, for example, if I just use physical, I don't use moral. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who developed his body to go beyond what normal people could do with weightlifting or whatever else he did, he reached a higher level within the fixed capacity of mankind. Pussinger, who's of a small build, no matter what he does, he isn't going to get up there.
I challenge that.
But unless he builds his body up to a point, you know, over time. But the bottom line is, this is the capacity, and there is a limit to what.
Well, but now you're introducing
his body.
You're introducing a new variable. You're introducing the variable of a maximum or a fixed amount, a cap for mankind, not an individual, but for mankind. Now, I think that's different than what we're saying.
Yeah, that is different. But I think we're really getting a far afield here. Because again, all of this is a suggestion brought by the Ralbach Frick so far that in any case doesn't really help us with the argument.
Yeah, that's...
Joe.
Jay.
But the idea that there is this fluctuating moral capacity that is set by God that we do not know about seems to be false on its very nature by virtue of the fact that he gave us the Torah that specifically has 613 mitzvahs that says that is it. And there are things that we've learned in the past that even said, and you shouldn't try to exceed that in specific things, you know, do a mitzvah better than it was said to be done. So that seems to be a fixed
standard.
Standard, yes. That's my point.
So the Ralbag would say in his interpretation of Zohar that although it's true there's a fixed standard of 613 mitzvot, every person is born with a different capacity vis-a-vis fulfillment of those 613, and there might be someone who has the theoretical ability to fulfill them all perfectly, and there's other people who have the theoretical ability only to fulfill half of them and only to a 50% level of perfection. And then every person is judged not according to the ideal standard of fulfilling all the mitzvot completely, but he's judged according to the standard of what he's innately able to fulfill. And if a person only has the inborn ability to do 50% of the mitzvot to a 50% level of perfection, and he reaches that, then he gets just as much reward as a person who did 100% of the mitzvot, 100% perfection. Each person's standard is different. And then over and above that, we now said that your standard could be variable and could move as you get better and better at it. To me, it all makes a lot of sense. Again, it's not helpful in our argument, but it does make sense, and I think it's fascinating to think about it.
I also believe it's not true.
Jay said a limit. You've set a limit, and
Okay, so, Jim.
But your moral capacity as an individual is always based upon your environment, which you were brought up on. And I use an example, segregation in the southern part of this country for so many years, and the degree upon which a person accepted or tried to change it. And the same thing happened in Europe, and with the anti-Semitism grew, and the individuals within them, which were not Jewish, and the right and the basis upon which they relied upon the church's teaching for what they did, the evil they did for so much. Those who accepted it completely, who participated in the Holocaust, who fought it. But it's all based upon how you fit into a society as it is.
And I think we can grant that point, that when the Ralbag talks about varying moral capacity based on your nature and your deeds, we can add into that based also upon your environment. Okay? I think that's probably true. So let's go back to where we are. And again, this argument is a dead end as far as the Ralbag is concerned.
The problem with that whole thing is that if you look upon it, people, moral capacity is subject to the greatest evil for the most part. If you look upon the South and you look upon Europe as anti-Semitism. So you would argue there that a person's innate moral capacity is more subject to evil than it is to good.
Okay, that's again a function of his interaction with this environment. So, going back to where we were, I'm going to read in other words. And again, this is his explanation of his development of this theory of variable moral capacity based on your deeds until now, your track record, your accomplishments. In other words, to the extent that a man's deeds are more perfect, his reward for one good deed is less than the reward received by someone who is not as righteous as he is. And that's a sentence that, without the discussion we just had for 20 minutes, would be hard to understand. But based on what we said, especially the weight training example, becomes very clear. As you get more adept at lifting that same weight, you get less and less reward as you continue to lift it. The reverse would be true for the punishment of evil acts. In other words, if you get into the habit of evil acts, then at that particular point, the standard is lowered. And the same thing in weight training. If you get out of a habit for 3 months and you go back to it, well, when you get back to it, you should get a higher reward for lifting less than what you could have lifted in the past, because at least you're lifting something now. But then the Ralbag says it doesn't work. But even if he, meaning so far, were to admit this, the difficulty that he wanted to avoid would still remain. In our empirical judgment of does the theory jive with the reality, we see evil befalling the righteous and good befalling the sinners. It still happens. This is quite obvious in light of our previous remarks. Okay? So it's a dead end, and so far cannot be resurrected from the dead, and his position has been rejected because it doesn't jive with reality. There's no way to say that all of the people have individual providence all of the time. No matter how much you stand on your head talking about variable moral capacities, it still doesn't jive with reality. And then the Ralbag gets to Bildad, rejecting Bildad on the basis of reality, empirical research, as it were. And what does Bildad say? Remember, all the people all the time have individual providence. If it doesn't look like it, well, then just further into the future you should look. Don't look at what the person gets today. Look what happens to him a week later and a month later, a year later, and further and further into the future. It is evident that Bildad's theory is also refuted by experience. We observe that many of the evils that are experienced by the righteous do not contribute towards their benefit. In other words, person does good and he suffers, and Bildad would say, but good will come of it, but it doesn't. It doesn't. We observe that many of the evils that are experienced by the righteous do not contribute toward their benefit. Rather, the righteous still suffer. The same is true of the goods received by the sinners. Right? You see a sinner getting good, you say, but he'll eventually get his just desserts, but it doesn't happen. In short, the distribution of good and evil to the righteous and the sinners proceeds according to Bildad's theory only rarely. Only rarely. It is evident, therefore, that Bildad's theory does not avoid this problem. The disagreement between these men in what sense experience itself reveals has been mentioned in detail in the book of Job according to our explanation of Job's reply to these men. Okay? And if you want to see that summarized on the sheets that I gave out, we're at the bottom of the second side. The bottom of the second side. And we just read there two, refutation of Sofar. Sofar posits that God judges by a standard relative to moral capacity, not by an absolute standard. An inherent moral capacity is hidden from the eyes of all but God. But this would not explain vicissitudes in what befalls the same individual over time when there is no observed correlation between good and bad behavior on the one hand and good and bad happenings on the other hand. For moral capacity remains constant over time. In the refutation of Bildad, Bildad posits that evil that befalls the righteous is ultimately to bring about some benefit, and good that befalls the wicked is ultimately to bring about some punishment. But experience shows that this is the case, but rarely.
The other problem you still have is there's such a difference. People always argue what's good and what's evil. Because we see that like in the state right now, as to a question about the funding of Planned Parenthood by the state. Which is a very, both sides are arguing that they're good, the other side's evil.
Yes. In the Ralbach's time, it was easier, I think.
Why?
It was easier because they had a much less pluralistic society. And at least among Jews, separately, they had their own absolute standard. Christians had a different absolute standard, and Muslims had a different absolute standard. But the Jews just said the Muslims and Christians are wrong, and the Christians just said the Jews and the Muslims are wrong. Today we have a much more pluralistic society, so that we see that there might be differential goods, and it's hard for us to decide which good is good and which bad is bad. That's true. And it makes this whole thing much more complicated. You're right, I think.
You see it throughout this the world today, is that throughout most of the Muslim world and increasingly in the Christian world, Israel is evil because of the boycott of Israel states. And can't you even argue that perhaps the Muslim and the Christian world have a built-in evil impulse? But the Christian world obviously has an evil impulse throughout the world, as you saw what happened in Europe and the Jews killed Christ. That was a built-in evil from the beginning of Christianity. And they continue with it today.
Anything I say won't be relevant to this class.
Well, they don't teach anymore in the Catholic Church that the Jews killed Christ. They have changed that.
A whole generation
of people that grew up with that teaching.
Some Christians still feel that way.
Only 1,000 years.
Yeah.
You know,
they're beginning to renege on that position, though. Yeah.
I'm giving this class that some of you have heard why the Jews rejected Jesus.
Yes.
And I'm giving it presently in other frameworks. I got an email just last night from someone who's taking the class, a very, very thoughtful and liberal thinker. And at the end of the email, he wrote to me that he's beginning to see how the roots of Christian anti-Semitism are right there in the New Testament. So that's true, I think.
Yes.
That's true.
You don't have to study and come to that conclusion. It's right there in front of you.
Yeah,
what do you mean he's beginning to see it? It's right there.
Well, most Jews don't learn the New Testament. And many times Jews, especially liberal Jews, when they read the New Testament, they make every effort not to see it because it's painful to think that there's a foundational text of one of the major religions of the world that's so...
Both major religions, the Quran also.
Okay, so we're really getting far afield here.
But let me make one last comment, then I will be quiet until after class.
Oh!
Okay.
Take it back.
I believe that your interpretation of that sentence, differences in the moral quality of their deeds, I have a little different interpretation, which I'll explain to you after class, which resolves the issue of a variable moral capacity.
But I have to wait a good 35 minutes, you're saying?
Well, I don't want to get off on a tangent. What we're talking about is something that we're saying is part of the proof that it's not true. So why spend over amount of time on something that's not going to be true?
Okay. Okay, so we are now at the bottom of 172. The last four lines. Indeed, and he's beginning a new subject, the views of these men, meaning Bildad and Sofar, who both hold that there's individual province for all of the people all of the time, are clearly refuted by the Torah itself. When the Torah warns men of evil because of their great sins, it states clearly that this evil will be that God will not look upon them and that he will abandon them to the contingencies of time. For it is said, I will hide my countenance from them. They shall be ready prey, and yet I will keep my countenance hidden from them. The prophet, may he rest in peace, says he who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. And because you have spurned the teachings of your God, I in turn will spurn your children and all the nations that are forgotten by God. This idea is repeated many times by the prophets and other writers inspired by the Holy Spirit. That is, the punishment of the sinners consists of God's hiding and indifference. God leaves them to the contingencies of time, and whatever happens to them is determined by the patterns of the heavenly bodies. God does not save them from the evil that is to befall them. These passages do not entail that God punishes them for their deeds by sending them evils, such that the latter correspond to the extent of the sins committed, as is claimed by the proponents of this view, Bildad and Sofar. The falsity of this opinion is clearly brought out by the words of the prophet, may he rest in peace, when he warns, I will not punish their daughters for fornicating. This shows you that when they are so deep in their sins, God abandons them to the contingencies of time and does not consider their deeds. Concerning those passages in the Torah, however, that threaten transgressors of the law with punishment, it shall be demonstrated in the sequel that they can be made consonant with what philosophy has proven with the passages that we have mentioned in the Torah and the prophets, may they rest in peace. So, what he's saying is that we should look in the Torah and the prophets and take note of the concept of Hester Panim. Hester Panim, I'll put it up here. Hester.
Hiding of the face.
Related to the word Esther, right?
Related to the word Esther, right. That when God is said by the Torah and the prophets to punish evil, it doesn't mean that he directly punishes evil tit for tat. If you did bad, I'll do bad to you. Rather, it means that if you do bad, I will not protect you from naturally occurring bad. I will hide my face such that my face, my countenance, the rays of my light, i.e. my providence, will not protect you from naturally occurring bad. And therefore, you will be open to chance. And whatever happens, happens. And since you're made of matter, eventually you will suffer the contingencies of matter, which means is to get zapped by an earthquake or to get a disease for something to happen to you, because that's the way the world is. And remember, the Ralbach holds that God did not create matter. And God has no control over matter.
God that did not create matter?
You missed that. Mm-hmm. The Ralbach holds, like Plato, that God created the world from pre-existing matter. Mm-hmm. It's like God came into the room, and there's a lot of Plato there, and God made the best possible world with Plato. But Plato eventually dries out and flakes away. What can you do? God did the best he could.
That makes no sense.
Well, what can I say? You can listen to the tape of the class.
From a scientific point of view.
From a?
From a scientific point of view, that didn't just happen. Something created it.
Matter was always here, according to
Matter was where?
Here.
Existing. Let's not get into it, Dorothy. It's not our subject at this point.
I'm glad I missed that class.
I'm not glad you missed it.
I have a tough time with that.
Well, according to science, we don't know what was in existence or not existence before the Big Bang.
That's true.
So there could have been matter in existence prior to the Big Bang.
But something created.
But we don't know that. So, but we don't
it
know.
Didn't just,
so well, I'm just saying what science position is at this point in science. So it's not inconsistent with science.
That's very consistent with the with Genesis.
It might be consistent with Genesis.
Consistent
might be.
With Genesis, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay, let's go on.
I don't agree with it either.
In any case, the Ralbag holds, right, like Plato, that there is pre-existing matter, and God did the best he could with that matter to create the world as he did. So, a providence is that when one does good, he is somehow, and we'll explain further on as we read in the book, he is protected from the evils that happen to matter. Whereas, if one does evil, it's not that providence punishes him, it's that providence refrains from protecting him. Then whatever happens, happens. And that's the matter of Hester Panim.
Question.
Yes.
Are we going to get to a clarification? Because what we're saying right now, that Ralbag's position talks about the face of God being withdrawn from, okay? But the implication being then the face of God is available to those that are
good,
at least some of the time.
Right.
Are we going to get to a point where he describes the definition of when it is and when it isn't?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. So, to summarize now, both Bildad and Sofar said that all of the people get providence all of the time. But the Ralbag says, no, the Torah contradicts that. The Torah specifically says that evildoers are punished by not getting providence. Right? This is brilliant what he's doing. He's saying the Torah promises you a lack of providence if you do evil. So how could you say that all the people have providence all the time? The Torah says the opposite. The punishment is that God withdraws his providence.
Is this all inferred that God is limited?
We talked about that extensively 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Extensively. And we just gave, I'll give you one example. Do you agree, Dorothy, that God can, or do you agree that God cannot commit suicide? Gotcha.
For himself or brothers?
For himself. And most of us would agree that God cannot kill himself. Does that mean he's limited? No, it just means that God is God and not different than God. The definition of God is he's always alive. Therefore, he can't commit suicide. That's not a limitation. That's simply what God is.
Well, the sheer fact that he created the world...
No, it just says that he's God. And he's not different than God. What God is the creature, the thing, the entity that created the world from existing matter. He can't create the world from non-existing matter because God, that's not God. That's a different idea. Anyway... back to originally scheduled programming. So let's read the verses in Deuteronomy that the Ralbag is basing himself upon. It's chapter 31. It's chapter 31 at the very end of the Torah, in which the Lord is saying to Moshe that these people, these Israelites, are going to sin in the future. After you die, Moshe, these people will sin. Okay, so it says here in verse 17 the following.
It takes effort not to sin.
Okay, so eventually people are going to sin. And what's going to happen, it says in 31:17 when they sin, then my anger. I guess people don't want to hear about this, so they're I'm fleeing.
I'm still looking.
Go ahead.
This is Deuteronomy 31:17-18. 31. Okay.
We're getting to the fire and brimstone, so everyone's leaving the room. 31:17.
Got it.
Then my anger will flare up against them, and I will abandon them, and hide my countenance from them. Then they shall be ready prey, and many evils and troubles shall befall them. Not because God brings the evils, but just because without God's protection, things will happen. And they shall say in that day, surely it is because our God is not in our midst that these evils have befallen us. And they'll be right about that. Yet I will keep my countenance hidden on that day, because of all the evils they have done in turning to their gods. That's it. So the Ralbag brings a proof here that you can't say there is providence for all of the people all of the time, because the Torah says there isn't. Now, the problem, of course, is that these verses in Deuteronomy do not reflect necessarily what the Torah says in other places. And there's many other places, like the end of the book of Leviticus, in which the Torah says explicitly something a bit different. It says if you do evil, it doesn't say God will hide his face from you, it says God will
punish you
directly. So what's the Ralbag going to do about that? And that's most of the verses of the Torah. So that's what the Ralbag said in the last six lines. Concerning those passages in the Torah, however, that threaten transgressions of the law with punishment, it shall be demonstrated in the sequel that they can be made consonant with what philosophy has proved and with the passages that we have mentioned in the Torah and the prophets. In other words, the Ralbag admits that you can't prove anything from the verses he just brought because other verses contradict, seemingly. Rather, what he's saying is the verses we just read in Deuteronomy, they afford support to the position he's already taken based on philosophy and science. And since that's the position, that's true, he's happy to support it by Torah verses, and those Torah verses that don't seem to support it will find a way to deal with them. I heard an interesting quote last week concerning statistics, that some people use statistics like a drunk uses a lamppost, more for support than for illumination.
That's cute.
I like that.
So the same thing for verses of the Torah. The Ralbag is basically saying explicitly, I use the verses of the Torah more for support than for illumination. Right? He's saying, look, we've proven the truth from philosophy and science, and now I'll show you verses that can support this. And if other verses don't seem to support it, well, we'll find a way to reinterpret those verses. I'm being a little bit here facetious about it, but this is pretty close to the truth.
Isn't it basically true, though, that you can take almost any position and you can find backup for it in the Torah and you can find contradiction for that same idea? I mean, religiously speaking, I know even in the New Testament it's the same thing. It's the book is variable enough that it covers every situation. So
there's a lot of truth in that. I'll agree that almost everything, but there's truth in that.
I don't mean this to be disrespectful to the Torah, but using the Torah to back up a position is almost an oxymoron, because somebody else can come along and in 5 minutes find another place which totally destroys the thought.
There is truth in what you're saying. And therefore, we have to be careful of people who support their positions with a verse here and a verse there. There really has to be a deeper study of the larger picture the Torah wants to create and see what positions are really consistent with the Torah. And it might be then that more than one position is consistent. That's true.
And what it basically says is that both positions probably are based on each.
There, I think, is deep truth in that. Although it's more complicated. But I think that that's basically true. Okay. So we are doing not so bad here. Let's see the summary of what we just read in the text. Let's see the summary in the summation sheets, just to make it easier to follow. So we are at the top of the third side. continuing where we left off in the summation sheets just 20 minutes ago.
Reputation.
And after the refutation of Bildad, which we read already, we get to the Torah. Many, many biblical passages, including passages from the Torah itself, say that evildoers will be abandoned by God to the contingencies of time. They emphatically do not say, that God will providentially punish them. Rather, they say that providence will abandon them. Now, by the way, I just want to remind everyone how this argument fits in with something we saw 2 weeks ago, perhaps it was 3 weeks ago, in the Ralbag. The Ralbag had said, remember, and this was really a mind-boggling claim he made, the Ralbag had said that by definition, God cannot punish evildoers. Why? Because God is good. And punishment is, by definition, bad. So God can't punish anyone. Remember? He had made that as a philosophical claim that you cannot say that God punishes the evildoers. He took 3 pages to say that, but I can say it in one sentence. God is good, punishment is bad, so God can't punish.
He turns his back on.
So now what the Ralbag is saying, I prove to you philosophically that God doesn't punish, and now I'm showing you in the Torah that God doesn't punish. Now it's two sides of the same coin. God doesn't punish. What God does, and this does make sense philosophically, God can withdraw his providence, but he can't punish.
That is punishment.
It's not direct punishment.
It's not direct punishment. A parent treats an adult child, punish them anymore. I mean, you can't physically punish them anymore.
Very good. Good example. You can withdraw your support.
That's
financial.
Good. That's good. Emotional as well.
Oh.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, a little child, you can spank, or God forbid you spank today, but you can punish them.
Yeah, a little child, you can withdraw their money. You can take away their money.
You can physically put them in a corner.
Right.
You can't watch television.
Right.
You know, blah, blah, blah. Up to the point where they reach physical strength that you no longer can physically or financially punish.
Right, that's very good. Well, say it again.
The problem with that is that you're narrowly defining the word punishment, and it's obviously emotionally punish somebody. It's more. It means more than the physical punishment in many respects.
Yeah, the root. I understand. I understand, but I still think there's validity to the point that he's making. I didn't hear. It didn't hear.
An adult is capable of doing that back to you.
Yeah. So I just want to make note that we've had two beautiful examples today of things we talked about. What Caroline brought up with the weight training, what Dorothy brought up with the adult child, that really they both fit to what we've been talking about. Let's go on. We have a little bit more time, about 20 minutes.
Can I bring up one thing?
Yes.
Again, you were discussing the fact was a matter before God created the earth.
Yes. So
if you go back to Genesis, very clearly it says the earth was void, which means lack of matter.
No, perhaps it... No.
It says unformed and void, which means lack of, lack of matter.
Or perhaps it means matter that was without form.
Well, that would take care of the not form, but void.
Void certainly means nothing but there.
That's a matter of the English translation. The Hebrew says tohu vavohu, and it's not clear what tohu and vohu are. Anyway, that's not our subject. We are now on page 174.
Yes.
A new chapter, chapter 4, called The Nature of Providence.
All right.
The Nature of Providence.
Okay.
And this chapter really only begins the subject of the nature of providence. Let us read. It's a page and a half, 174 and 175. Okay? Perhaps I'll begin by reminding everyone of medieval epistemology, something I've talked about many times. Epistemology is, let's say, the science of knowing, of intellection. We've talked about the fact in the past that according to medieval understandings of Aristotle, knowledge is a thing. It exists. There's a body of knowledge. It's not something human beings create. It's rather a broadcast that they pick up on their receivers or they don't pick up. But it's a given. It exists. Now, where does knowledge exist? It exists in God. God is knowledge. How does knowledge get down to earth? How do I pick it up? It's brought down to earth through a series of 10 stations that relay it down to earth, 10 broadcasting towers. And the last and the lowest of these broadcasting towers is called the active intellect or the agent intellect. And if you want to associate it with a certain heavenly body, it's the moon. The moon is the last way station in relaying divine knowledge down to earth. From the moon, it is broadcast, and those who turn on their radio receivers to the right channel, they get it. And those who don't turn them on don't get it. And again, this way station, this last way station, is called the active intellect or the agent intellect. So in the framework of study of human knowledge, when we talk about the agent intellect as broadcasting knowledge down to earth, we can basically talk about the agent intellect as a lower representative of God. So for our purposes, we can use agent intellect and God interchangeably. It's the agent that has knowledge such that to know we have to latch onto that broadcast from that body, from that thing, from God. Here we go. Since it has been shown that it is false to say that there is no individual province at all, right? You can't take Aristotle's position, that's not true, that there's no province at all. And that is also false to say that there is individual providence operating in each and every person, right? So we have destroyed Aristotle, we've destroyed Eliphaz, destroyed Bildad, and so far, all that's left is the Ralbag. He's the only one left in the ring standing.
It's kind of a biased attitude he has.
He's the one that destroyed it.
He has knocked down all the other positions. It is evident, therefore, that individual providence must operate in some people, but not in others. That's the only remaining position. It's not in no people, it's not in all people, so it must be in some people. I've won the argument, he says. It's in some people, but not in others. That this is the case can be shown in another way. In other words, until now, I have proven my point, he says, by way of elimination. I've knocked down all the other positions. Now I'll take my position and advocate for it in a positive fashion, not just in a process of elimination. That this is the case can be shown another way. It is evident that what is more noble and closer to the perfection of the agent intellect receives the divine providence to a degree greater and is given by God the proper means for its preservation. This is clear from what has been said in the Book of Animals by Aristotle. For whichever animal is more noble is given more means for its survival. I'll explain what he just said. He said something very simple. That he says that the more perfect an animal is, the more capacity it is created with to preserve itself.
Survival of the fittest.
But he's not talking within species. He's talking comparing between species. For example, flies, house flies, are not so noble. They're not such well-developed creatures. They don't exhibit the divine perfection as much as a gorilla does. And since a fly exhibits less of the divine perfection, therefore God gave it less means to preserve itself. Whereas gorillas are in a higher level of perfection, they're closer to God as far as exhibiting all the capacities God could give. They're on a higher level than flies, and therefore, since they're on a higher level, God gave them more of a capacity to preserve themselves, because God wants gorillas more than he wants flies.
It's all based upon how good your IQ is.
I don't know if it's IQ, but it's...
That's what it says.
Doesn't use the term IQ.
It doesn't use the word IQ. Nobler.
Intellectual perfection.
No, we didn't get there yet. That's only talking about individual human beings.
All right.
Okay.
Could it be the ability to reason?
He hasn't defined it. He's just said nobler. And I'm defining it as partaking more of the divine qualities, more of divine perfection, as opposed to other animals that have less of it. I can't define it better.
More created in the image of God than...
Perhaps. More created in the image of God.
Is this another way of saying moral capacity?
No, it's not about the moral capacity. I think he holds that cats are more nobler than flies, but it's not because they have a greater moral capacity. They're just closer to perfection. They're more intricate, certainly, right?
Certainly.
But he's talking about the perfection of the Asian intellect. Talking about.
Yes, that's true, because it's through the agent intellect that everything on that earth happens. Even creation, I didn't say this earlier, I apologize. Thank you, Harry, for pointing that out. It's not just that human beings know through the agency of the agent intellect. It's rather that everything that happens on earth, including creation, happened through the wave stations that transmit the divine energy down to earth. That's a good point, Harry. But again, for our purposes, we can equate agent intellect and God.
No, they're not talking about agent intellect and God. They're talking about agent intellect and people.
The agent intellect is God.
God's creations.
The agent intellect is what creates creations.
The problem here is that Harry is taking the words literal and you're using it as a label.
Oh, right. Agent intellect is the name of a certain way station that brings the divine energy down to earth. That's what it is. It's a fixed entity. You can call it the fingers of God if you want.
I'd rather not.
Okay, so anyway, I want to take note of a sentence we just read. It was the sentence beginning at the end of the fifth line, beginning with the word it. It is evident that what is more noble and closer to the perfection of the agent intellect received the divine providence to a greater degree and is given by God the proper means for its preservation. Note in that sentence that the Ralbag seems to be equating two concepts. Concept number one is divine providence. Number two is the proper means for its preservation. Those two concepts have been equated. That is to say that, again, we look at the fly compared to the gorilla. The gorilla is more perfect, more intricate, created better, as it were, than the fly. Therefore, the fly has been endowed with less ability to protect itself because God's less interested in flies than he's interested in gorillas.
And yet there are millions of flies and very few gorillas.
Yeah, but gorillas live longer. Although, let's not get into that. So, just further point out that this means of preservation that God has granted more to gorillas than to flies, the Ralbag equates that with providence, with divine providence. Just think of that for a second. Absorb the idea that the fact that a gorilla, as a species, is given by his creator more abilities to preserve himself than a fly has, that is an example of providence. Just look at the way we're using the word providence. Providence is not just a matter of miraculous intervention in nature by God. Providence is a matter of the way God created the universe to begin with, to allow ourselves to take care of ourselves. That itself is providence. I'm not saying there's not more to providence, but that, at least on one level, is what providence is. So expand our definition of providence. We've done this exercise before.
I'm regressing just a little bit because I'm not sure that I understand the distinction when I said that this moral cap was what we're talking about, because maybe this goes back to the definition of morality, but from a societal position, a moral act is probably synonymous with the preservation of a species, because it is the preservation of the species. So if that's the case, then, and maybe it's not, if that's the case, then why isn't this nearness to perfection, and the definition of this perfection is the degree of moral capacity for an individual?
Where there is no moral capacity of animals.
Why not?
Well, okay, then what you're saying is that my assumption that morality is
merely
by the attainment of the preservation of the species is incorrect.
Is a problematic argument.
Yes, I'll buy that.
There might be some truth in it, but it's not a full argument. Okay, so let's go on now. Since man exhibits different levels of proximity to and remoteness from the agent intellect by virtue of his individual character, those that are more strongly attached to it receive divine providence individually. What that means is that human individuals are all different, and some people are more or less attached to the agent intellect. Providence is proportionate to that more or less attachment. Now, I'll explain. What is this matter of attachment to the agent intellect? It goes back to what I said 10 minutes ago about the medieval theory of epistemology, of intellectuation. Because when I know something, what I'm doing is turning on my radio to the channel that's broadcasting it. Who's broadcasting it? The agent intellect, that is to say, God, is broadcasting it. That is to say that when I learn truth, at that moment, I'm connected to God through the broadcast. And if I'm connected to God through the broadcast, then I should get providence at that moment because I've made a connection between self and God. Says the Ralbag, based on classical medieval epistemology. And since some men never go beyond the disposition with which they are endowed as members of the human species and do not try to attain perfection so that they could become close to the agent intellect, indeed, some of them increase their imperfections with which they have been born as members of this species. Such people are obviously not within the scope of divine providence except in a general way as members of the human species, for they have no individual perfections that warrant individual providence. Accordingly,
that seems to address the point that I was making. He's making a distinction between the two in that sentence.
Okay. Accordingly, divine providence operates individually in some men in various degrees, and in others it does not appear at all. So I want to explain what he said by looking at the sheets that I prepared. So we're in the sheets, we're in the middle of side three. We're in the middle of side three, number three. And the heading is individual providence is operative in some people but not in others. Chapter 4. That's the chapter we're learning right now. Okay? And I wrote as follows. This is the logical conclusion of the elimination of the two other possibilities as we talked as on the board. This can also be supported on two other grounds. Number one, which we just read in the book. The different species of animals are differentiated by the nobility and perfection. Those species that are more noble and perfect are granted by God greater providence and natural means for their preservation. Okay? Now, while individuals of the animal species are all on the same level of nobility and perfection, human beings are all different as to their nobility and perfection, depending on how well they've developed their intellect. Therefore, the gradations of providence that differentiate between animal species should also be found among the different human beings. And I will draw that on the board. The Raldog says we have a scale. And we have flies, and we have cats, and we have dogs, and we have horses, and we have gorillas, and we have human beings. And progressively, going up the scale, these creatures are more noble. And as they become more noble, they're granted by God greater means for self-preservation, the species I'm talking about. So gorillas know how to preserve themselves better than flies do. And that is an example of divine perfection as a function of nobility. Okay? Divine providence as a function of nobility. Gorillas have more divine providence than flies do. Why? Given that they're more noble, they're closer to God. Therefore, God gave them more means to preserve themselves, and means to preserve themselves means it's called, wait a second, it's called providence. So says the Ralbach, what is true in the gradations, I said it wrong, in the gradations of species should also be true within the human species. Because just like flies, we'll say it different, just like cats are better than flies, and dogs are better than cats, and horses are better than dogs, and gorillas are better than horses, and human beings are better than gorillas, so within the human species, one person is better than the other as far as their nobility, that is to say, as far as their perfection and closeness to God. And therefore, if it's true that from species to species, there's more providence based on greater nobility, therefore the same thing should be true within the individual of human species. That individual humans, if they're closer to God, should have more providence than those who are less close to God. That's his point. And that is a philosophical proof for his position that not all people have equal levels of providence, but everyone has less or has more, and some have none. When you get to a human being, we'll all have the basic providence that distinguishes human beings from gorillas. All human beings are more noble than gorillas, and therefore have better means to preserve themselves than gorillas do. However, that's the generic providence that's good for all human beings. Within human beings, some have made themselves better and some haven't. Those who haven't made themselves better have the basic level of human providence, which is better than gorillas, but they don't have the better levels of providence that you can get by being a better human being. So again, it's a philosophical argument saying that there must be some human beings that have no special level of providence beyond what all human beings have.
I question your construction of the scale.
So do I.
When you talk about nobilities, man, ever since the founding of man, Cain and Abel, what happened? One brother killed another. What about man today? They're still killing each other off. So where's the nobility of man?
The Rambam agrees with you. And the Rambam says that human beings that don't perfect themselves are as bad as animals.
Not the Ralbach.
But the Ralbach doesn't agree with you.
Okay.
This is actually a very interesting point that Harry brought up. The Rambam comes to what you would call a very, very inhumane position. Because he says human beings that don't perfect themselves are as good as apes, so we can kill them. The Ralbach doesn't take that position. The Ralbach takes the position that, to begin with, even if they don't perfect themselves at all, human beings are still human beings.
I have a problem with equating this nobility and perfection with the ability to perpetuate the species.
Not equating, but one is a function of the other.
Well, the cockroach is the most noble around, and human beings aren't. And gorillas are very near extinction. So, I mean, his chart does not fit with reality.
Yeah, that Harry, I think, put that up a little bit earlier.
Reality.
I mean, you might interpret it as being a way of interpreting within humankind, but when you bring in all the other species as your argument, it doesn't really support the position, I don't think.
I hear. Reality was different in the time of the Ralbach. There were more Kyrillis than cockroaches.
I'm not sure of that either.
Yeah. No, but they were preserving themselves better than cockroaches were. You can also, I see, disagree with that. I see. Okay. Good point.
The problem with that is you can't say all
cockroaches
people,
made it.
Because it depends upon the religion. Because obviously in the Muslim religion, the greatest perfection of a person going to heaven is a suicide bomber, as we all know. And he's absolutely perfected himself, and he goes to heaven with anybody else. So how can you? It's based upon the religion.
Okay, you're right. The Ralbach is within our tradition of what is nobility and perfection, but in his day, this definition was shared by Jews and by Muslims, at least philosophic Muslims.
But not now.
Well, that's.
I don't know. Okay, so we've closed our class. See everyone next week.